I'd like to call this meeting of House Judiciary to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:01 p.m. on Monday, March 23rd. Present today are Representative Klayman, Representative Bloomberg, Vice Chair Keller, and myself, Chairwoman Ledoux. I'll remind everybody to begin with to please silence their cell phones. And it's Representative Tammy Wilson Day in House Judiciary. We have one previously heard bill before us, HB 15, Credits for Time Served, Good Time, sponsored by Representative Wilson. And we have also another bill, also sponsored by Representative Wilson. That's HB 11. So the first up will be House Bill 15, Credits for Time Served. This is the third time that we have heard this bill today, and I'm hoping that we can move it out today. So first, HB 15, the bill sponsor, Representative Wilson, is here with us today, and we have a new CS for this bill, 29-LS0102/I. May I have a motion to adopt this new CS?
So move, Madam Chair. I move the LS0102-I India be the working document in front of us for the committee action.
Thank you. Hearing no objections, we've adopted this as the working document. Representative Wilson, will you please put yourself on the record and brief the committee on the new CS version I for HB 15?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson, North Pole, District 3. I will never, ever again, I promise here in front of you, say a bill is simple. I have learned my lesson. So with this bill, what the change is will be on page 2, and we had counseling where it now says, rehabilitative activity. We talked to the public defenders, and they thought that this would be give more tools to the court to determine what kind of helps the person who is in pretrial. And if I could, this has gone through a long trail so far, Madam Chair. So I just want to explain exactly what the current bill in front of you does. Okay, so you've been charged with a crime. You've not been found guilty. You've just been charged with a crime. You have the option of bailing out, having a third party possibly, or sitting in jail. If currently you are sitting in jail during pretrial, you get credit for sitting in jail. What this bill does, Madam Chair, it makes it so the court will have another option. And that option is for a third party, and the third party, instead of being a person, is electronic monitor, which of course a business is attached to that. And this is what I have been told it would work. So you go in with your public defender or your attorney, you have the district attorney there, and you have a judge. And you go in and you're going to discuss with the courts what they are going to require of you while you're on electronic monitoring. It could be certain kinds of treatment, you may have a job, you might do community service, but all that will be discussed. The other question is, how do we know whether this monitoring system is something that we can trust? Again, the judge gets to ask questions of the company, as well as the the public defender hopefully already knows, but the district attorney, and everybody in the room has to be on board that this is what we're going to be doing before it happens. Again, there's not treatment in a lot of the jails that we have, and especially not for pretrial. Most of it happens after you've been convicted. And so what this does, if you follow everything you've been asked to do, you will get credit, the same credit that we're giving those who are sitting in jail. I just thought, Madam Chair, it might help to kind of go back to we're only talking about pretrial, because we kind of got down a little rabbit's trail last time about what if they weren't in Alaska. They are in Alaska for pretrial, all electronic monitoring. You cannot do it out of state. We asked for those kind of issues. We couldn't find anything that they weren't on probation already. So this is pretrial in it. So with that, I am willing to take any kind of questions that you may have. And I thank you so much for the learning that I have gone through because of this committee and the great questions they really have. And I think we have a much better bill because of that.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions? And also, I'll note that Quinlan Steiner of the Public Defender Agency and Carrie Belden from the Department of of Corrections are online if anyone wants to ask them questions. Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may ask a few questions.
Certainly.
Representative Wilson, first of all, I hadn't thought of this until now, but the term medical appointment on line 6, I assume you're using that in a broad sense, so it wouldn't have to be with an MD, but it could be with a nurse practitioner or a naturopath or a chiropractor or a physical therapist or something like that. I'm not intending to define it here, but I just would like some legislative history that you're intending a broad definition, which obviously will be interpreted by the correctional officials. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenberg, it will be up to the judge.
Okay.
And the judge will be making that determination of exactly who you could see. And back to legislative intent, that would actually be put down in the document that you're seeing Dr. such and such at this address. Because again, if you break this, unlike if you're just out on your own, they're going to know where to find you, and you go to jail if you break any of this agreement.
And if I may follow up with another line, we talked a few minutes ago about the language on page 1, the line 11, which is, if the person has not committed a criminal offense while under electronic monitoring. Literally, that could be read to include electronic monitoring 15 years ago in Rhode Island. As I understand it, it's your intent to have a narrower focus on that, and we talked about that generally. I'm not seeking anything other than hopefully an agreement that we're going to look into this further and try to see where this goes.
Representative Gruber, through the chair, this is information. This was put in by law because they wanted to make sure that, unfortunately, there was an incident that, that someone was on electronic monitoring, that they did commit another crime, and that, to me, that would be, you need to necessarily say that. They felt it needed to be there. So we will have further discussions with law to see if there needs to be a few more words that would be added.
But the intent
is that while you are on electronic monitoring, again, you have to abide by the rules that are here and cannot commit any other crimes.
Of course. And do we have somebody from law who's available?
We have somebody from the Department of Corrections and the Public Defender's Agency. And we do have somebody from the department.
Maybe at the appropriate time, I can ask Mr. Slobodny through the chair.
I think this would be the appropriate time since we are on this subject right now. So, Mr. Slobodny, would you like to join us up here?
Madam Chair, my name is Rick Sabatini, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, and I do have some remarks that I wanted to make, but I'd certainly be happy to answer Representative Greenberg's question first if you just repeat it.
I would be happy to yield until we hear what he has to say, and then later do it. Whatever you wish, Madam Chair.
Why don't we get the question answered first, okay?
Sure. The question, again, if you could please.
Yeah. Let me read you the language on lines 10 and 11 of page 1. A court shall grant credit against the sentence of imprisonment for time spent under electronic monitoring, and this is the key phrase, if the person has not committed a criminal offense while under electronic monitoring, and then it goes on, and the court imposes substantial restrictions, etc. I am seeking some clarification and hopefully agreement on a concept here, that you're talking about a criminal offense under electronic monitoring that is somehow either related to this case or in the recent future, so you couldn't, my example was, use a 1985 situation from Rhode Island. That would make him ineligible for life.
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, it was my understanding, and actually I think Ms. Schroeder worked with the sponsor on this language, and it's my understanding that it would be for this offense. Now, there's another issue with that. I mean, I know that We've had multiple instances of people who commit crimes, not incident. The incident was a sexual assault. I think that grabbed more headlines than the selling drugs in the park and things like that. But I think if you're giving credit under the present case law, pre-trial, if it's the functional equivalent of incarceration, that at least so far under present law, you are going to get credit for that time, whether you commit a crime or not. It's just like the person who's didn't get out of jail commits a crime in jail. That they're still a second crime while they're waiting, they're still going to get credit for the time they've been in jail. That's kind of the whole principle of credit for time that's either in jail or the functional equivalent of jail.
Madam Chair, I think that how this proceeds we'll have to work on, but I think under the circumstances, and I've offered to the sponsor my help on this, her and her staff, and you should get the Department of Law. I'm not sure exactly where this is going, but I just wanted to highlight that I think there's still, we have to define the contours a little bit down the line, and I think it goes to finance.
Thank you. Before we proceed any further, I would like to note for the record that Representative Foster has joined us. So do we have any other representative claimant?
Thank you, Mr. Spivani. I want to just make sure I follow a couple of things in terms of the process. A person who, the way the bill is written now, a person who might be a released pretrial on electronic monitoring would be treated the same in terms of credit for time served as a person who was released pretrial to a treatment program.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, yes, that's my understanding of the bill also and how it would work.
And for the fault. I think there was an earlier version of the bill that was trying to get involved in the calculation of good time credit, which is really what happens when somebody's in jail, either pretrial or post-sentence. But this bill is not trying to get into the actual good time credit accounting process pretrial. It's just a day-for-day credit if you're released, so you would be treated the same for counting for credit for time served, whether you're on electronic monitor or in a treatment program.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, that's how I understand it. I mean, good time is for good behavior in jail, and here you aren't in jail.
But
so it got dropped out of the bill.
And then another follow-up through the chair. The actual process of a judge granting credit for time served pretrial, the process is basically the defendant, his lawyer, the prosecutor, and the judge come to an agreement that shows up as a pretrial release order that says you'll go to, in this case, electronic monitoring. And then when they come to sentencing is when the judge will actually look and see how did you do, and if they did what was asked of them, then the judge at that point will order that they get credit for time served. So it isn't, they don't get the credit for time served before they come to sentencing. They get an understanding of what they'll need to do to get that credit, if I'm describing that accurately.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, you describe it accurately. I think there's a lot of nuances that kind of are there that's not in the premise of what you said.
If you could explain what you...
Well, let me just maybe, if I may, Madam Chairman, my remarks.
Go ahead.
Everybody, I think, is not paying attention to or forgot didn't know the default is you get out of jail. The default in the statute, unless it's an unclassified or a Class A felony, is that you're released on your own recognizance. So there are a certain group of people who are released either on their own recognizance, but as a requirement of being on their own recognizance, they go to a treatment program that has the equivalent of that program, like you're in jail. You can't leave at night. You can't go to a date in the evening. You can't take your fiance out to dinner. There are those type of equivalents of being in jail. Or the court could say that's also a condition of a monetary bail, wouldn't be a third-party custodian, I think as was mentioned earlier, because I assume the third-party custodian is not going to go to the functional equivalent of jail pending trial. So that, you know, they may have a third-party custodian at some different point. It is also not the case that when you go to that hearing that everybody's on board. There's only one person who needs to be on board, and that's the judge. The defense, I assume, is going to argue for it, but the prosecution shouldn't. So we shouldn't call this an everybody's on board with this bill. It's the judge who gets to make that initial decision. So with those kind of as premise remarks as to the process, it seems to me there's just there's a major public policy question that you have to ask yourselves. Should we let people buy their way out of jail? Because that's what this is. I mean, who wouldn't, if they're facing, for the lawyers in this room, if you got a client, they're facing 3 days in jail for a DWI mandatory, begging the judge to put this guy on electronic monitoring. And I'll tell you, if the bill passes, I may retire and go into the business of putting people on that, because that's what everyone's going to do. Because what have you done? You've defeated the principle that you have to serve 3 days in jail for your first DWI. 20 days is the second DUI. That's a cakewalk. Retract that word. That may be something that everybody's willing to do. Go home at night, have an ankle bracelet, don't drink, 20 days, you plead out on the 20th day and say, Judge, I was on an ankle monitor, I was at home, and I didn't even do any of these things. I go to counseling. And, you know, I don't want to get off on this rabbit trail, but when you use that word counseling, it reminds me of the woman, you know, who committed perjury in a trial, was sentenced to jail time and claimed that going to Weight Watchers was the functional equivalent of rehabilitative program, and she should get credit for going to Weight Watchers appointments. I mean, that judge didn't give that, but you've certainly changed the focus from a rehabilitative program to counseling when you change those words.
So am I hearing, I mean, you've testified before, Mr. Slobodny, on this bill. Am I hearing that the administration and the Department of Law are officially opposed to this bill? Because it's certainly sounding like that from your testimony today.
I testified before, and I think I've made these same points, but now we're down to specific examples. I don't think my testimony's changed. What changed is the sponsor, Ms. Schroeder, worked on language. That came before you. Now it's not changed back. Now it's in a different iteration. But the fundamental question is still the same. If you let people pay for electronic monitoring to get out of jail, what you've done is say you've moved us back to the Middle Ages, where somebody can do their jail time. I can have somebody pay somebody to do my jail time for me, or I can pay the king to not have me go to jail. And that's really, I think, the fundamental question. There are additional areas of concern. For example, is the victim going to be there when electronic monitoring's imposed? They have a right to be heard about jail. Now you've kind of flipped the whole process around. Where does that victim show up? I mean, if she or he shows up at sentencing to say, now this guy should go to jail, judge, and the judge is going to say, oh, sorry, Lord, we did that at the bail hearing. I think Representative Klein wanted to ask a question. So.
Now, go ahead, Representative Kleinman.
Not to change the, well, unless things have changed since I was a young attorney and you too were a young attorney, the victim, as I understand it, has a right to be present at every bail hearing, as well as at sentencing, and make comments, and this bill wouldn't change the victim's right to be present at every bail hearing and offer their view, recognizing that the ultimate decision about whether to release them under the terms is left to the judge. I don't see this bill as changing that fundamental right of the victim to be present at the bail hearing.
Through the chair, that's absolutely right. But there's a substantial difference if you call somebody and say, there's this bail hearing, do you want to come? Or this guy's being sentenced, do you want to come? There's a whole
different dynamic. Wouldn't that be the responsibility of the person at the Department of Law, giving that victim the information about what's going to be going on at the bail hearing?
Madam Chairman, that's absolutely right. That's what we do. We will try to inform them that, yes, this guy's going to be living in his house. Yes, he's going to wear an ankle monitor, but yet that's going to count as being in jail. And they have a right to be at the bail hearing. Judges often give them the right to speak. They don't necessarily have the right to speak at the bail hearing. They do have the right to speak at sentencing.
And then the other follow-up through the chair, I've lost my train of thought. I'll come back to it.
Representative Greenberg.
You said the defendant doesn't have a right to speak at a bail hearing. Well, if the defendant or his lawyer or lawyer are asked in for electronic monitoring, they must have the right to speak to make that argument.
Sure, if I did say defendant, I misspoke and meant victim.
Oh, the victim. Well, if I may.
Go ahead.
If we agree that the victim has a right to be notified and present at a bail hearing, doesn't it follow under the constitutional amendment and the enacting statutes that if the victim or the victim's advocate had an objection to the the proposal, they would have a right to be heard on that? And if it's a bail hearing or anywhere else, why wouldn't they have that right?
Through the chair, there are certain times when victims have a right to be heard. And I said that they didn't necessarily have a right to be heard at a bail hearing. And that may be wrong in retrospect. They may have that right. But remember, you know, if you're being sentenced, you get some time to know about it. You know, you don't get, I mean, in Anchorage, the first bail set before the victim's even home. They're set by committing magistrates over the phone. That's probably not going to happen where people are released to these programs at that point, but there's a hearing. It's going to be the next day. You know, it's not like you can sit down and write out your thoughts, or, you know, you may not even be out of the hospital yet.
Yeah, please.
Yes, and then I've got a question for Mr. Slobodka.
On this point, could I can yield to you?
No, just go ahead, Representative Greenberg.
You're making it sound like it's impossible to do this. Certainly the Department of Law, through the chair, ought to be able to accomplish this. Is this something that's not capable of being executed through the chair?
I'm not sure if I understand the question, but if the question is, can the Department of Law draft a bill that allows somebody to get credit for time in jail by staying at home wearing an ankle monitor? Sure, this bill does that. That's not the issue. The issue is, are you willing as a public policy to say that should, to create the legal fiction that that's being in jail?
Mr. Slavani, doesn't the bill say and as I'm reading it, you look at line 12 to 14, and the court imposes substantial restrictions on the person's freedom of movement and behavior while under the electronic monitoring program, including, but that word including, court appearances, meeting with counsel, and period during which the person has to do X, Y, and Z. The judge could impose, those are just the things that this bill says that you wouldn't even think about giving a person credit if they hadn't met those three requirements. The court could impose other restrictions.
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct.
And so there has to, the court has to find that it imposes restrictions in the court's mind which are equivalent to, which substantially restrict the movement of the person.
That's also correct, Madam Chairman, that substantially restricting the movement of a person, I mean, where you can go to work, you can go to Weight Watchers, you can,
Well, not necessarily go to Weight Watchers. If the court views that Weight Watchers is more of a social thing, then, I mean...
The answer is yes. A judge can create situations where living in your own home is, in the language that the bill uses, is the same language that comes from a case where the court also used, this means the functional equivalent of jail. They said, guess what? It's on electronic monitoring. They said, no, it doesn't meet that standard, the Court of Appeals did. But that's not the, the issue is that if you stay at your home, you wear an ankle bracelet, and those are the only two things you do. This says the court shall give credit for that being the same as jail. And that seems to me to be creating a situation where the people who can pay to have an ankle bracelet and take 3 weeks off, 3 days off if it's a DWI, 20 days off if it's a second DUI, 20 days off from work, they're not going to get jail time for that offense. And that's within your prerogative, that's within a judge's prerogative. Now if the judge ratchets it down more than just saying that it is, curfew at night and an ankle monitor. Yes, the bill can be written. It's a public policy question that, it's your call. I mean, if you say, staying at home, wearing a bracelet is okay. And I just want to mention one other potential side effect of that, the potential increase in the delay in going to trial, because if you're a good defense lawyer, client's willing to stay home for a while, you're going to want to drag it out as long as you meet whatever sentence you think the court's going to give.
So going back to my former question, is the Department of Law and the administration officially opposed to this bill?
Madam Chairman, I can tell you what I see as issues with the bill. I don't believe the administration has a position on the bill, and the department, from the prosecutor's point of view, is that it's your call. There's no question about that. It's just you have to, if you say staying at home and wearing an ankle bracelet, being in jail, that's okay. But you got to be up. That's your call.
Thank you. Did you have further questions, Representative Klayman? And I'll note for the record that Representative Mellett has joined us.
The question came back to me. Mr. Svobodny, through the chair, the topic that you raised having to do both with financial access to electronic monitoring, typically in the private criminal defense client, not typically in the public defender client, is something we've discussed on the committee on some of the meetings you had the pleasure of missing. But the other one is there's a geographic issue, too, that in certain parts of Alaska where the technology presently doesn't exist, this becomes more available to defendants in broad terms of the Whale Belt and probably Juneau, but unlikely in western Alaska and some of the much smaller, less populated communities. That's been identified previously, but it sounds like the position of the Department of Law is if we as a committee want to allow that to be more available in some communities than others, that's a choice we can choose to make.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I think so. I mean, I don't think you can legislate, I mean, that's the type of thing you make, decisions you make all the time, I mean, about where programs are available and where they're not.
Right. Okay. So, thank you.
Does anybody else have any questions for either the bill sponsor or for Mr. Slabati, Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I raised some of these issues when we talked about this bill before. Sort of thinking through further on the subject, when the legislature first considered ignition interlocks in the 1980s, and I was involved with that, we didn't consider all of these issues, the financial ability of somebody to afford it. I don't recall that coming up. But I do recall a discussion of geographical issues. They were quite different because the discussion at that point not only related to whether there were facilities available in various locations, anywhere in Alaska for that matter, to install ignition interlocks, they were very new. And for a while there wasn't anybody who could do it in the state. So that definitely became an issue, but I don't recall any legal challenge being raised to that. But there was some discussion, and I know the legislature did consider the lack of availability in certain circumstances when we debated that bill, which is, I think, somewhat similar to what we have here.
Was that a question?
No. I sort of meandered away from the question, yeah.
I'm hoping that you might hold it to questions, and then when we get to the bill discussion.
I guess I would. We didn't talk about the equal protection issues, and I'm going to just ask my usual, if I could, Madam Chair, any comment on either of those?
On equal protection?
Yeah.
I mean, about interlock devices.
No, that was just an example.
Equal protection as it relates to, we have a system that's going to treat the people who have money better than the people who don't have money. And by that, I don't mean they get a nicer jail cell or they necessarily get better representation. But if a judge sets $100 bail, it's easier for me to make it than it is for somebody who's living on the street to make it. I mean, that's just inherent in our system. But judges may take that into consideration. What's going to keep me from skipping out maybe a lot higher than $100, so my bail may be a lot higher than the person on the street. A judge can weigh that in determining what bail is going to be set. I mean, there are two factors. I mean, and that's actually what I started with by saying the default is you get released, and the judge looks at two factors in determining what bail is appropriate. What's the flight risk, and what's the danger to the community. And that varies from person to person, rich or poor. But, you know, it's generally easier for somebody who's got some money to make the bail than it is for the person who doesn't.
Mr. Slavodny, right now a person would get credit under our current law for time spent in a overnight rehabilitation program, correct?
Madam Chair, I don't know if that's the only requirement, whether they would. They have to have restrictions that are similar to being in jail. So if I were going to a treatment program that allowed me to do everything that I wanted to do except show up at 8 o'clock at night, go to a meeting between 8 and 9 and get out at 8 in the morning, I don't think you'd get credit for that.
But if it's a live-in, I guess what I'm getting at, some of these treatment facilities are quite nice. I mean, and so I guess you could argue that to let somebody who has money go into a pleasanter treatment facility could discriminate and against somebody else who doesn't have the money to get into that pleasanter treatment facility. But we still don't say that they don't get credit towards their time served.
Assuming that they have the equal equivalencies of being incarcerated, you can stay. A judge could fashion an order that you a treatment under present law, a treatment regime that got you into kind of the Bellagio in their bungalows, if they had a sufficient equivalent of incarceration, there was only certain times when you could be there, that you were eating there, that you went to the program there, and there are exceptions in present law that allow for meetings with counsel and things like that. But yes, I mean, it doesn't, you know, you...
I mean, I'm not sure...
Past history here is one of the members of, not this committee, but of this body, went to alcohol treatment at the Maui Hilton, right?
I'm not aware of that, but assuming that the Maui Hilton or someplace else has a residential treatment program, that would be allowed.
Yes, ma'am.
So that's the same thing, isn't it?
I guess
your statement about, well, this wouldn't be fair because if you have money, you can get the electronic monitoring, and if you don't have money, you can't get the electronic monitoring, and therefore you wouldn't get the credit, would be the same thing as saying, well, if you have money, you can go into a nice, which we already allow right now, a nice residential treatment program, and if you don't have money, so I guess I would think that in considering this bill, what we need to be considering, and maybe not in this bill, but in some other bill or in the course of the Department of Corrections, making it so that people who don't have money are able to participate in this electronic monitoring. That the problem is not that right now people with money can do it and people without money can't do it. That might be the problem, but that's a problem that could be corrected not by this bill, but by other considerations within the Department of Corrections, that there's nothing inherently wrong with giving credit for the electronic monitoring.
Madam Chair, if you conclude that you know, people going to a treatment program, no matter where it is, that has the equivalency of being incarcerated, is the same as staying at your own home and wearing an electronic monitoring. That's your choice.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Slobodny? Any further questions for the BIMS sponsor?
Can I correct something?
You certainly can come back up for like a wrap-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, again, Representative Wilson. And I just want to clarify a few things. Lunch Legal did work with Mr. Slobodny, so I'm fairly surprised to hear him here. Okay, if you read the bill, it has to be as if you were in jail. You cannot just be on electronic monitoring, sit in front of the TV. You have other avenues that have to be met. And for those of you who haven't been in jail, okay, what makes, and I was only there to watch.
Hopefully.
I was not in there, yes. You go in, you can sleep all day if you want. They bring your food to you, but the only thing that they require is that you change your clothes once a week. Okay, I think this bill actually requires more things that you have to do. Not just the court appearances, but actually getting treatment, working, doing community service, doing something to get your life back on track. And, you know, I've been listening to the legislature for the last few years, and we're trying to find ways so that we quit doing this revolving door. Do you truly believe that the judges are going to say sitting at home doing nothing is equivalent to being in jail? Actually, that's probably darn close, but I don't think they will. I think they're going to use the bill and say, you need to do these other things as well, because we want to make sure that you don't come back. And that's the opportunity that this bill gives that you don't have right now. I wish that every time someone went in, we could give them the treatment they needed, Madam Chair, and that we could actually have rehabilitative services, whatever we do, but we just don't, and especially not for pretrial. Most of those services don't even happen until you've been convicted, and then you have to be so far into your term before those even open up, if there's room for it. And the other part of it, the Department of Correction right now could do the monitoring. So this whole thing about whether you have money or not, Health and Social Services allows money into it. The Department of Corrections can do it right now. They can do it to any community. They could go to NUM, they wanted to Constitute, to Kenai, to any areas that may not have it. That opportunity is already there. What's not there is what I'm hoping this bill is, a little bit more of an incentive of going to jail for $158 a day to electronic monitoring for around $20-something dollars a day. And it's, you have the cost, and then you're actually getting them back on the road to recovery, which I think is what we want long-term. And change is always very hard, obviously, because if you worked with all these agencies, you would know my frustration. But ultimately, Madam Chair, I hope after this bill gets through its way that we somehow, maybe through this committee, get these four agencies together at the same table and figure out what they're going to do to get along and make sure that we're all doing the same thing. I think this is an exceptional bill. I think it's what everybody's been asking for. I've worked very hard with everybody, but every time you make a change, somebody else doesn't like it. So I have done my best. So thank you.
So it's gone from a simple bill to now being an exceptional.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Thank you.
So Representative Wilson, one concern that I have is, I mean, I generally like this bill.
Thank you.
And so I like the idea if somebody is going to be in prison for, let's say, 2 years, and they've gone and they've gotten the rehabilitation, and they've spent 2 months, let's say, in a rehab or under the electronic monitoring, doing what your bill is trying to have them do, that they get 2 months off their sentence. What I don't like is the idea if somebody had a 3-day prison sentence for drunk driving, and so their entire sentence, I mean, part of that 3-day prison for a DUI is to make people who might not normally ever see the inside of a jail actually see the inside of a jail. And I mean, for many people, when they're sitting there in the bar trying to determine whether they should have that last drink, the idea of, oh my God, I could end up spending 3 days in jail. And I'm not sure that the idea of spending 3 days with an electronic monitor, being able to go to work, being able to do whatever one normally does, even though you're restricted for those 3 days, I'm not sure that that's quite the same thing as going to jail.
Madam Chair, excellent point. This is a tool in the toolbox. The judge doesn't have to do it. They can say it might be better for them to spend the 3 days there. They don't have to let them on electronic monitoring. It's an option that's available to them. And as far as the 3 days goes, if that works so well, I don't think we'd have so many people coming through the jails all the time. But that's just my opinion. But this is a tool. This is not a requirement by the courts. The courts can determine whether or not they want to utilize this or not, whether or not, depending upon what kind of crime they committed, they may say they're not eligible whatsoever. Again, it's up to the judge. It gives them one more tool to utilize when they're looking at all the other options they have. They don't have to do it. They can deny it and say, no, you're going to go spend 3 days or 10 days or whatever. And some of those have mandatory jail sentences. And if they're mandatory jail sentences, you can't go off on this side. If it's required now by our DUI laws to be 3 days in jail, it will be 3 days in jail. It's a tool. It just says, if you go on electronic monitoring, it must be the same as jail. You must do these things. But it doesn't say the judge has to allow it. It's up to them.
Actually, the...
Can I give a follow-up on this?
Yes, go ahead, Representative.
Representative, you're actually talking about something that's very interesting because, as you know, Representative Wilson, I have an amendment that
the right to use an amendment,
that I am soon to propose, which would change the language to shall to have it say may. And it seems to me that the example you just described, when I actually took a moment and I looked at the DWI statute, and what the DWI statute requires in Title 28 is that on the first DWI, the court has to impose a sentence of 72 hours consecutive imprisonment. But I am fairly certain that imprisonment in the world of this credit for time served statute would actually make imprisonment under this arrangement, whether it be a treatment program or an electronic monitoring, the judge, if the language in the statute says shall, the judge would have no discretion to say, well, Mr. Defendant, I understand that you're an upstanding citizen, you have been very successful, you have lots of money, and I don't care how good your treatment program is, it can be the Betty Ford Center or the Maui Hilton or wherever, I want you to sit in the big house for 3 days and see what it's like. If this language says shall, the judge would be required to let this person do it at home with the monitor, whereas if the language says may, the judge could say, even though in many circumstances I wrote it, in your case, you've been drinking too many times, I actually want you to see what it's like in there. The judge would then have the discretion under my amendment to say no to one person, but yes to everybody else.
Representative Clement, your chair, thank you for letting me be so helpful to your amendment.
Do we have any further questions for Representative Wilson? Okay. Then, do we have any amendments on this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move. I have an amendment that is very good. My glasses on, so I can read all this. I think it is Amendment 29-LS0102/L.1, and this amendment would change on page 1, line 5, and page 1, line 9, change the word shall to may in both those instances. And since I've already spoken to the amendment,
and I'm going to assume that the committee sponsor, so seeing, do we have any objections? Seeing no objections, the amendment passes. Is there any further discussion?
I just want to thank Representative Wilson. She and I both have this habit of sometimes working in the building later than some, and we've had more than one late night discussion about this bill on many fronts, and I have to give Representative Wilson credit for being very receptive to talking about this a lot and sharing ideas and About an hour ago, she still wanted it to say shall, but she made it. She made my case for me.
That's what committee discussion is all about. Okay, can I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move ACS for HB 15 version India as amended out of committee with individual comments and attached zero fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, the bill passes from committee. Can I have a brief of ease so everyone can sign? On record. So we next have HB 11, continuing in the Tammy Wilson Day bills. So Representative Wilson, you're still here with us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson, District 3. Obviously, I don't learn my lesson very easily. So you may remember parts of this bill from last year, Madam Chair. There was a bill that actually took those who were found not guilty or that they were dismissed charges, that it would go off what is called court view. Court view is something you can go on the internet to the Alaska court system and you can look up your friends and your neighbors and your dates and anyone else that you want to see if they have any type of record. And it does show all the kinds of records, and it does say on there when you go to please read all of it. I don't know if many of you have been on it. It can be very confusing trying to look down to find out whether or not someone was convicted of it, what part of the crime they were convicted, sometimes just to even find out whether or not they're innocent or guilty. Last year, the bill would have taken it off of court view and taken it away from the written record if you went into the courthouse. This bill does not do that. This bill only takes it off of court view. This is something that's been worked out with the courts, and that way they're not sealed as what they would have been last year. And there was a lot of concern, Madam Chair, about that. And I still truly believe, I love that bill, wish it would have gone through, but I also understand some of the concerns that are out there. It is one that was put up court view at the time, which is kind of interesting since we've been talking about policy decisions today. Interesting that this wasn't a policy call by the legislature, but it was a policy call by the courts to put these records up in the first place. So what this bill does is, as I said, is that if you go to court and you're found not guilty, or all charges, as you'll see on page 2, the defendant was acquitted of all charges filed in the state, all criminal charges against the defendant in the case have been dismissed, or the defendant was acquitted of some of the criminal charges in the case and remaining charges were dismissed. And what it says, a lot of times when you are charged, it's not just with one thing. Sometimes it's 5 or 6. And you'll hear about plea deals, and they'll only do one. What does that mean? Is only that one on court view? No. All of them would stay on there. It's only if you've been acquitted or of all the charges would it not be on there. As well as if they combine two cases together, again, it would be the whole package. Why would we want to do that? I truly still believe that you are innocent until found guilty. And this bill represents that it shouldn't be all to see. I have heard many stories, some very heartbreaking ones, on jobs that they were not able to get, apartments that were being judged because just being on court view itself put doubt in people's mind on your character. And I don't think that was ever the intent of anyone for that. I think it was literally going to just be informational, and that's all it was supposed to be. But it's gone much further than that, and I think this is the right step to getting us there. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Representative Wilson? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Representative Wilson, this bill, as introduced, was quite similar to Senate Bill 108 from the 28th Legislature, which was vetoed by Governor Parnell, right?
Correct. Through the chair.
Do we have copies of that bill and or the veto message to distribute? Oh, they've been distributed. Okay. Before I really ask the representative a lot of questions, are we going to be hearing from the Department of Law and or Public Safety on this bill, Madam Chair?
I have one person signed up for questioning, and that's someone from the Department of Counseling and Social Services. There's nobody else that I'm...
Casey Schroeder just called. She's on the way in.
Okay. Well, that answers that question.
I'm reserving the right, maybe ask questions later. I'll start off with the lady from the Department of Law, Ms. Schroeder.
Okay. She is not here right now, Representative.
I have a question for the sponsor.
Okay, let's have questions for the bill sponsor first.
Now that we're all warming up.
Yes.
Through the chair. Representative Wilson, we've got the Senate Journal and the Senate bill. I don't see the governor's veto message. And can you give me a...
That is not veto message.
Okay, I'm seeing correctly. There is a veto message. Then the second question, again through the chair, have you communicated with the current administration, or the new administration, to see where they are on this proposal? Because I recognize there's significant issues about closing any court records to public view, whether it's online or in person, and we've certainly gone to being a very internet-friendly society, and the notion that we would have certain records not available on the internet while there's apparently all kinds of things, while all kinds of people available on the internet it presented interesting questions, but I'm just curious, do you know where the current administration sits?
Through the Chair, Representative Clayman, it was my understanding from the administration that they were in favor of the original bill, so I'm assuming that taking out the ceiling part of it would not make them, you know, against it. I want to clarify, too, that I did file the original bill, and because that was the only way to do it. The courts at that time, for whatever reason, and I'm sure you can get that answer today, was that they didn't just want it necessarily off of court view. When we refiled the bill, we were approached by the courts that they were now willing to look at just taking it off of court view. Because I think one of the biggest issues was the sealing of it, and not just the sealing of the records so you couldn't even go in and look at it, but they were also going to offer what was known as a portal for some of the agencies to where you could still kind of sit at the office and look in. I don't think anybody was for sure that that would work. It sounded like a good idea, but whether or not it would have actually done what it did, this still gives the avenue that if you want to know badly enough about everybody who could possibly be in there, you still have that avenue. You can't just sit at home and just, you know, put out there. And the other part of it is, too, you got to remember there's newspaper articles for everything. The internet's not just about court view. None of those records would be influenced whatsoever. This is only about court view itself. And again, it has to be underneath just those purviews, not everyone. But I think the courts can also discuss what they did do after the veto and how they did help some others that had issues that might help clarify things as well, Madam Chair.
So you say the internet is still available. You mean if somebody else is in, if let's say a victim or an alleged victim is interested enough to go photocopy the records and then stick them on the internet themselves in some way? Or?
Madam Chair, first of all, when you, again, are arrested, it goes up on court view. That would still happen. As it goes through the process in court, that would also stay up on record. Not until we get to the acquitted portion of it or to where you're found not guilty. 60 days after that happens, it would go off of court view. And so victims, judges, everybody could follow the case all the way through to the very end. It's just at the end, once you've been found not guilty, it wouldn't be there 10 years down the road where somebody could still look at court view. The other provision I was making, because we had some questions earlier in my office, well, what about the internet? Because it's a big, you know, worldwide area. Well, when crimes happen, it's not just court view that puts it up. I can Google you, Madam Chair, and find many things about you, all good. That is, you know, and the courts would have no say-so on those types of things. So I just wanted to clarify when it says internet in the bill, we're talking only about court view itself.
Thank you.
Question?
Representative Bennett.
Thank you. So one of the issues that we had with the Senate Bill 108 last session was the victims' advocacy groups were interested in still having access to those that may have been charged with a crime and gone through a plea agreement. Those cases would still be on court view, correct, if they pleaded out to a lesser charge?
Representative Noel, through the chair, that charge would be and everything else. So if there was five charges, although the other four might have been withdrawn and only the one, all five would show up.
And have you talked to the victim advocacy groups about the how this bill's written?
Representative Noel, sure. They have received the first copy and this one. They said they were going to get their comments to me. This was at the beginning of session, and I have yet to receive anything in writing except that they did get the information.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Anybody else have any questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, Representative Kenyon.
We're still waiting for the Department of Law.
You have the courts here, though, sir.
We do have somebody from the court system here, so. Do you want to ask the court system, or do you want to ask...
I'll wait.
You don't have a question, then, for... Representative Greenberg, did you have a question for somebody from the court system?
My first was to the Department of Law and Public Safety. I don't know if we'll fit. I don't think so.
All right. At ease. Mead here? Yes. Representative Kenyon.
Thank you. Ms. Mead, actually, I should let you identify yourself.
For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I'd be happy to answer any questions about this bill.
Representative Wilson just noted that after the governor vetoed the bill that was before the legislature last session, that the court system made some changes about records that are available online. So can you tell us about the status of it now, and then as a follow-up, so I don't have to ask the question again, what flexibility does the court system have without legislative action to make steps on its own to provide some degree of restrictions?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, the court system does have some categories of cases that administratively it has decided should not appear on court view, even though the case file is not confidential. And it has an administrative rule that lists those case types that it does not feel are appropriate for posting on court view. And last year, it was actually before the governor's veto, the court amended its rule in that regard and added some categories of cases as it learned, just as I think the legislature is learning, that people used court view for purposes other than, you know, purely case management purposes. So last year, the court took the step to amend the rule to remove from court view, basically, is... criminal cases that were dismissed because the prosecuting authority declined to file a charging document, criminal cases dismissed for lack of probable cause under Criminal Rule 5D, criminal cases dismissed for an identity error. There's about 10 or 12 categories like that. One large one is where petitions for domestic violence protective order was filed. Those are filed by citizens without any district attorney involvement. And at the very initial hearing, the ex parte hearing, a judicial officer found that there was no probable cause to find domestic violence or that there wasn't a domestic relationship occurring. And that happens quite a bit, that somebody files a domestic violence protective order, but they're not at all within the bounds of what a domestic violence protective order is. The court learned that that can be held against a respondent, as you might imagine, even if the court finds right away, you know, within 24 hours at the hearing, that was basically an unfounded petition. So those were removed from court view, and again, in response to sort of complaints from people about their name being on court view undeservedly and the negative consequences that they were suffering. So that's what the court did about 9 months ago now, and did remove cases from court view and did so retroactively. And I'm not sure if that fully answers your question or if I forgot the second one.
No, I'll follow through the chair. The second part is how much, without passing a bill like this, how much latitude does the court have to basically restrict what is put available on the Internet of court records? I guess it goes to the question which you can't really answer, but I'm just curious in terms of the court's authority.
how much do we really need to be acting in this area if the court is really aware of the issue of kind of misuse of court data? Mm-hmm. How, if the court's aware of it and trying to be proactive about this, how much do we need to get involved in it at the same time?
Okay, through the chair, Representative Clayman, I understand your question. I believe it's the court's position that the court could, has the authority to put onto court view or take off court view anything that it wanted to. I believe it would be within the court's purview not to have court view publicly available to people. It is a case management system. I think the court could decide not to post cases on court view and to have only people coming to courthouse for public records. I mean, the court does have its own public records law and does believe in public access to records, but that would be within the court's authority to decide not to put more categories of cases on court view. The court has, as I say, recently amended its rule and did what it thought was appropriate for it at the time. The legislature can do more, but the court did what it thought was appropriate.
So without legislation, the court actually would have the authority to not post any of these things which are encompassed by this bill on court view.
Madam Chairman, I believe that's the case, that the court could take some additional categories of cases down from court view. That's right.
And why or why not? Why has the court chosen without legislation to continue to post cases where somebody has been totally acquitted? What is the court's rationale for continuing to post?
And to the chair, I will be a little bit cautious in answering the question because I don't predict what the Supreme Court justices are thinking, but they went as far as they felt it was appropriate to go administratively. But since this decision, the decision to remove from court view cases, criminal cases where somebody was acquitted or dismissed, is, as we have seen, somewhat more controversial. It is less an administrative function of the court. It is more of a policy decision that affects Alaskans, and Alaskans differ in their views on this. We learned that last year with SB 108. And because it was much more of a policy question than the more straightforward ones that the court decided to take down administratively, the court was not prepared to take that step, leaving it more for the legislature. So in other words, if the court did do that administratively, I think they believe that that might not be serving the public as well. The public wouldn't necessarily know to comment on an administrative decision on that, and it is, as I say, more of a policy decision for the legislature than an administrative type decision for the court. It could do it, but I believe that's its thinking as to why it did not.
So does the court system have any position on this bill?
We do not. We are neutral on the bill. We can do it. You know, we did it with other case types through our IT department, but we have no official position on it.
Thank you. Representative Millett and then Representative Grunberg.
Ms. Mead, so I have a question. Why, can you tell me the origins of court view and why the court decided to put their case management on public anyway? I mean, what was the driving force behind making the case management public in the first place?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Millett. The court view was purchased as an electronic case management system for the benefit of court staff and attorneys who have cases in court, and it was never intended to be a tool to do a sideways criminal background check on somebody. It's not the official criminal background check repository in the state of Alaska. It never was intended to be that. It has become an expedient for people, a useful tool, but originally it was intended to be our case management system. It isn't particularly wonderfully user-friendly, I think, for a member of the public to go in and look and figure out everything that's going on. But it is good for court staff to track cases.
you can be at the Fairbanks court and find out what's happening on a case in the Bethel court within the same judicial district without going and pulling the files. You know, if you think of electronic medical records, it was an updating to the way that we kept track of all of our cases, and it was very useful for the attorneys in the case to be able to go and see a new action in their case, and attorneys got very used to it. We put it online as a help to the public and to attorneys, and it has been quite popular. It's only in recent times that people are thinking that perhaps it's abused by some people and improper conclusions are drawn from some of the documents that are on there. We do have a warning at the initial screen when you go on to court view saying, be careful, don't draw improper conclusions. Anyhow, that's the history of it.
And follow-up. And have there been complaints from the public about inaccuracies on CourtView? I know that there's a lot of, like you said, misuse of CourtView to do either a background check or check out your neighbor. There's a lot of nefarious uses of CourtView if you don't understand how to read a case document, or you don't see the continuation of a court case, or you don't see the dismissal, which you have to look for on CourtView to find out if it was dismissed, if it was pleaded out, and even then you can't get a lot of the information online. So it's not a complete history of the case, it's just court appearances. Not necessarily all of the court actions, but I see all the appearances on there. So my question is, do you get a lot of complaints from the public that says there's misinformation on there? I mean, I can go out and file a domestic violence charge against Representative Ledoux, make the case that because we live in close proximity, I fear her, and that would show up on CourtView. Just the action itself, not whether it was dismissed or not, it would just show me filing a charge, filing a protective order against one of my colleagues.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, a couple of things. I don't hear complaints that there are inaccuracies on CourtView. I think our staff is quite good at entering the data. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't some mistakes. There are many, many hundreds of thousands of cases on CourtView. But the complaint that I've heard has not been that the data that's on there is not accurate. And perhaps, and this is purely anecdotal, and I don't have any idea how widespread this is, that people do look at it and draw improper conclusions because perhaps they don't understand what it says. One clarification is CourtView includes not just court appearances, but anything that's filed in a case, any piece of paper that's filed in a case. It is our index, our docket sheet of every single thing that's in the paper file. So from an entry of appearance to a motion to a court order, everything is listed in CourtView. I suspect that some people may misunderstand what they're reading. And then one final thing is that if you were to file a domestic violence protective order against Madam Chair, that in all likelihood would be found at the very initial hearing to be unfounded. And as I mentioned, under the court's administrative rule, that would come off of CourtView. And that was one of the adjustments the court made on its own, as I say, in the last 6 or 9 months when it adjusted that rule. So that situation in itself was addressed by the court.
Madam Chair, I won't be filing domestic violence.
Any other questions for?
Did you want me to yield to you?
No.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm reminded of the famous line from Guys and Dolls, where Nicely introduces Big Julie and says, "This is Big Julie, been arrested 27 times, convicted never." And that's the kind of thing that I'm concerned with. Having practiced family law, I've seen both sides. Circumstances where people use domestic violence kinds of cases, either out of vindictiveness or to gain instant custody of the children on an ex parte basis. And I've also seen them dismissed where people are afraid or are the syndrome where they bind with their abuser and they go back into the abusive relationship and they dismiss. I'm somewhat concerned using that as a paradigm why this law, when it came, this bill, Senate Bill 108, was one of the most difficult issues I've encountered since I've been in the State House. The veto message contains a discussion of so many issues that really all merit close attention before we make a decision in this area. The court system published, did they publish a rule? Is there a rule on the subject, a court rule?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, I believe you're asking about what I've referred to as a recent change in the court's rules as to what it posts and doesn't post in court view. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, it's Administrative Rule 40A.
Did they amend, through the chair, did they amend that rule to accommodate either court view or what they're doing with this on court view?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I'm not sure I understand your question. The amendment to Administrative Rule 40A added about 8 new categories of cases that the court would be removing from court view and subsequently did remove from court view, though the cases still remain public.
Madam Chair, would this bill, in the form it's presently before the committee, would that have any effect on Administrative Rule 48? Would this change that rule at all?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the court does not view this bill as incorporating any sort of rule change.
If I may, please. Did the court publish these changes or Rule 48 in its role as a procedural rule or as a substantive rule like the child support or Rule 82? In other words, my question is, if we were to do any amendment to Rule 48, would that require a two-thirds vote, an amendment to a rule, procedural rule?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, there's a substantial question as to whether legislature can amend administrative rules. The court doesn't consider those rules of practice and procedure. The court doesn't view this as an amendment to the administrative rule, and therefore we don't see a problem with your deciding to take this tack in this case. And I hope that clarifies.
May I inquire one question or two? This is something I had not remembered before.
Along the same line, is this a follow-up or?
Kind of. Well, let me ask it and you can roll in. If there's a court system, believe there are certain rules that the legislature does not have a power to amend or do anything with at all, that you're completely immune from legislative review?
Representative Greenberg, that doesn't seem to have anything to do with this bill. I want to keep this discussion to this bill.
Okay, that's fine.
All right, thank you.
I'll pursue that at some point, because it's interesting.
Through the chair, on this bill.
Yeah. Do you have any comment on my statement before on how difficult, how this thing can cut both ways? And any comment from the court system on that, through the chair?
I don't have any official comment on that. I understand that your job can be difficult. That's all.
Thank you. Representative Keller.
I want to ask, Jim Green's question a little differently. If this had been the bill last year, would it have required the court rule change that happened?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, if I understand your question, I think that the court has decided that the legislature has authority to act in this area and doesn't see it as an amendment to Rule 40. You can take this action without the court thinking that the legislature is improperly amending some court rule.
I think it's very valuable that this gets in statute. I thank the sponsor for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Representative Klayman.
Well, a bill like this raises a lot of different issues, both in terms of protecting people who are charged improperly with crimes. I mean, perfect example, we've talked about the domestic violence situation where Chair and Representative Millett really live at least a block apart and not in the same house, and the court would appropriately reject that as a domestic violence case. It wouldn't show up on court view. In the news, more troubling to the public is we've seen a lot of things in the news about rape in college campuses, and where you sometimes have a number of people that are alleged to have raped one individual, and so there'll be a whole issue about what is the college doing about it, and the real concern about are these individuals actually raping people on campus. And the prosecuting authorities take one look at the case and say, under these circumstances, we're not even going to take this to grand jury because it would be too hard to prove and we would lose it every time. And so you have this real conflict between a public interest in wanting to know who has been charged with a crime, and rape is one of the ones that people have the greatest trouble with. It's hard to prove prosecution-wise, so a lot of those cases actually don't get brought to grand jury, and that would be a part of the cases that wouldn't show up on court view. And people would be concerned that those folks were getting sort of a free ride, if you will. And on the other hand, if they don't have the evidence to prove it, why should they be showing up and having their character impugned when there's not enough evidence to prove them guilty of the crime? And it's, on the public level, I think it creates a lot of concerns. I gather this really only gets to court view and doesn't necessarily involve what's accessible to the public or the press that's active enough to go down to the courthouse and look for records. So in some ways, this only is affecting court view and not the bigger question about what's broadly accessible to the public.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, right. This bill only affects what's on court view, and that is a change from the version that was in the legislature last year that would have made the cases confidential. That's right. Under this bill, somebody could still go to the courthouse and look into somebody's cases, including those which were fully dismissed or acquitted. But the court, if this bill passes, would remove those cases from court view.
And for purpose of through the chair, those would be accessible on the courthouse database and not just physically looking through one file after another. But a person would go down to the courthouse today, not on court view, and look up a case and find the Ledoux Millett domestic violence action was filed, and then the judge ruled that they weren't they had no such relationship that could be subject to a charge.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I do want to clarify that the hypothetical, even though I know everyone is joking, is off court view now because of the court rule. That has nothing to do with this bill.
Right.
Okay. So.
What about not court view, but what about if I'm down at the courthouse and asking to use the public access computer?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, this bill would allow people to go to the courthouse, look at a computer, and find cases about somebody that ended in dismissal and or acquittal.
And that last follow-up to the chair, does this go further? This bill would go further than the current administrative court rule?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, further in that it speaks to cases coming off court view that are not mentioned at all in the court rule. It is a different beast.
Right.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Mead? All right, thank you very much. Does the bill sponsor have anything further that she would like to say at this point?
Sure.
Again, for the record, Representative Wilson, District 3, North Pole. I guess I just want to remind people, every person is innocent until they're found guilty. And I think Courtview has done an excellent job of trying to warn people and others that this isn't an official way of looking at. However, we become, you know, techies as it goes, and sometimes we just look because we want to know. But by very definition, Madam Chair, a person is not a criminal if acquitted at trial or if their case is dismissed by the courts. We are considered innocent until proven guilty. HB 11 champions this principle. We ask that Alaskans who have not been found guilty of any wrongdoing be given the right to emancipation of social distress and inherited prejudices. And that's what this bill does, is finally get them back to where they were before the unfortunate incident happened. And with that, thank you so much for hearing the bill. We'll make sure that we have comments given to your office if the Department of Law has anything that they heard that they'd like to address.
Thank you. Representative Greenberg.
Thank you. Three things. And public safety, I'd like to know what their views are, too. Secondly, has your office made any inquiry on whether any other states have addressed this issue? And if so, how have they handled it? Has Ledge Research done anything like that for you folks?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, what we've been able to find is very few states even allow this kind of access outside of the courts. And again, I think the courts, Ms. Mead, I find it interesting that anybody, health and social service, any public safety would have a database like this online if it really was only meant for a few to see. I wish what they would have done is it would have been passcoded and all utilized by those that they thought would. And again, I think when it came up 10 years ago, I don't think anyone knew we would be in the position we are today.
And finally, and this is one thing I should have asked Ms. Mead, and you could see I was trying to think before she left. At some point, I'd like if the staff could distribute Administrative Rule 40A so we can see what the court rule says. And we don't need that today, but I'd like to know what they say.
I'm sure we'll make sure your office has that and distribute to all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Keller.
Could I make a comment, Madam Chair, instead of a question?
Why don't we open public testimony? I don't think there's going to be that much of it because I see nobody online, and then when we have discussion, you can make your...
Fair enough.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, is there anybody yet on from law or...
No.
No one? Okay.
All right. I am at this point going to open public testimony. I won't be closing it today. There doesn't appear to be anybody online for testimony. We have Jane Urbanovsky from the Department of Counseling and Social Services. Department of Counseling and Social Services. Okay. And just available for questioning. Do we have anybody in the audience who wants to testify? Does anybody have any questions for Jane Urbanovsky? All right. Then I'm not going to close public testimony because we're going to be hearing this bill at some later time. Let's bring it back for committee discussion. Representative Keller.
It's probably not worth anything, but I'm just sitting here thinking that this is caused partly because of technology, you know, the internet being available. And that got me to thinking about a question I really didn't want to ask because it's too broad, but the whole idea of defamation, you know, how that used to be a very cut and dried, unless we understood what was going on, and the libel suit, you know, and those kind of things are just changing, and they're changing because an accusation is easier to read in social media than any kind of an extended defense. And that's why I appreciate this coming forward. I think it's, you know, there may not be an easy answer, but I at least taking the step it seems important to me because we're in a day and age when an accusation can be absolutely devastating. Yeah, so. Anyway, for what it's worth.
Thank you. Any further comments?
I have one question, if any.
Question to
me. To Representative Wilson.
Just one question that came to mind. Have you given any thought to whatever we do, putting a sunset date or something like that, making a temporary act so we could see the effect, review the effect after a few years?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, you know, I go sleepless nights trying to figure out what question you'll ask next, and I would never have thought of that one. I guess I'm not opposed to that. It's an interesting concept, but again, I guess I want to remind you that, you know, people pay a lot of money and a lot of time and heartburn for things that they may have been just in the wrong place at the wrong time. I seriously believe that we owe this to people. But thank you very much.
To the chair, and I wasn't at all. I don't know what question I'm going to ask next.
All right. Do we have any more questions or any more comments? All right. This meeting is now adjourned. It is 2:35.